Chapter 4. The Adjacent Possible. The concept of L-space, short for library space, occurs in several of the Discworld novels. An early example occurs in Lords and Ladies, a story that is mostly about elvish evil. We are told that Ponder Stibbons is reader in invisible writings, and this phrase deserves and gets an explanation. The study of invisible writings was a new discipline made available by the discovery of the bidirectional nature of library space. The Thaumic mathematics are complex, but boil down to the fact that all books everywhere affect all other books. This is obvious. Books inspire other books written in the future and cite books written in the past. But the general theory, there is a special theory as well, but no one bothers with it much because it's self-evidently a load of marsh gas. This aside is a footnote in the original quotation, so this is a meta-footnote, or a meta-aside. Anyway, the general theory of L-space suggests that, in that case, the contents of books as yet unwritten can be deduced from books now in existence. L-space is a typical example of the Discworld habit of taking a metaphorical concept and making it real. The concept here is known as phase space, and it was introduced by the French mathematician Henri Poincaré about 100 years ago to open up the possibility of applying geometrical reasoning to dynamics. Poincaré's metaphor has now invaded the whole of science, if not beyond, and we will make good use of it in our discussion of the role of narrativium in the evolution of the mind. Poincaré was the archetypal absent-minded academic. No, come to think of it, he was present-minded somewhere else, namely in his mathematics, and it's easy to understand why. He was probably the most naturally gifted mathematician of the 19th century. If you had a mind like his, you'd spend most of your time somewhere else too, reveling in the beauty of the mathiverse. Poincaré ranged over almost all of mathematics, and he wrote several best-selling popular science books too. In one piece of research, which single-handedly created a new qualitative way of thinking about dynamics, he pointed out that when you are studying some physical system that can exist in a variety of different states, that it may be a good idea to consider the states that it could be in, but isn't, as well as the particular state in which it is. By doing that, you set up a context that lets you understand what the system is doing and why. This context is the phase space of the system. Each possible state can be thought of as a point in that phase space. As time passes, the state changes. So this representative point traces out a curve, the trajectory of the system. The rule that determines the successive steps in the trajectory is the dynamic of the system. In most areas of physics, the dynamic is completely determined once and for all. But we can extend this terminology to cases where the rule involves possible choices. A good example is a game. Now, the phase space is the space of possible positions, the dynamic is the rules of the game, and a trajectory is a legal sequence of moves by the players. The formal setting and terminology for phase spaces is not as important for us as the viewpoint that they encourage. For example, you might wonder why the surface of a pool of water, in the absence of wind or other disturbances, is flat. It just sits there, flat. It isn't even doing anything. But you start to make progress immediately if you ask the question, what would happen if it wasn't flat? For instance, why can't the water be piled up into a hump in the middle of the pond? Well, imagine that it was. Imagine that you can control the position of every molecule of water and that you pile it up in this way, miraculously keeping every molecule just where you've placed it. Then, you let go. What would happen? The heap of water would collapse and waves would slosh across the pool until everything settled down to that nice, flat surface that we've learned to expect. Again, suppose you arrange the water so that there was a big dip in the middle. Then, as you let go, water would move in from the sides to fill the dip. Mathematically, this idea could be formalized in terms of the space of all possible shapes for the water's surface. Possible here doesn't mean physically possible. The only shape you'll ever see in the real world, barring disturbances, is a flat surface. Possible means conceptually possible. So we can set up this space of all possible shapes for the surface as a simple mathematical construct. And this is the phase space for the problem. Each point, location, in phase space represents a conceivable shape for the surface. Just one of those points, one state, represents flat. Having defined the appropriate phase space, the next step is to understand the dynamic, the way that the natural flow of water under gravity affects the possible surfaces of the pool. In this case, there is a simple principle that solves the whole problem. The idea that water flows so as to make its total energy as small as possible. If you put the water into some particular state, like that piled up hump, and then let go, the surface will follow the energy gradient downhill until it finds the lowest possible energy. Then, after some sloshing around, which slowly subsides because of friction, it will remain at rest in this lowest energy state. The energy in this problem is potential energy, determined by gravity. The potential energy of a mass of water is equal to its height above some arbitrary reference level, multiplied by the mass concerned. Suppose that the water is not flat. Then some parts are higher up than others. So we can transfer some water from the high level to the lower one by flattening a hump and filling a dip. When we do that, the water involved moves downwards, so the total energy decreases. Conclusion, if the surface is not flat, then the energy is not as small as possible. Or to put it the other way round, the minimum energy configuration occurs when the surface is flat. The shape of a soap bubble is another example. Why is it round? The way to answer that question is to compare the actual round shape with a hypothetical non-round shape. What's different? Yes, the alternative isn't round, but is there some less obvious difference? According to Greek legend, Dido was offered as much land in northern Africa as she could enclose with a bull's hide. She cut it into a very long, thin strip and enclosed a circle. There she founded the city of Carthage. Why did she choose a circle? Because the circle is the shape with greatest area for a given perimeter. In the same way, a sphere is the shape with greatest volume for a given surface area. Or to put it another way, it is the shape with the smallest surface area that contains a given volume. A soap bubble contains a fixed volume of air, and its surface area gives the energy of the soap film due to surface tension. In the space of all possible shapes for bubbles, the one with the least energy is a sphere. All other shapes have larger energy and are therefore ruled out. You may not feel that bubbles are important, but the same principle explains why Round World, the planet, not the universe, but maybe that too, is round. When it was molten rock, it settled into a spherical shape because that had the least energy. For the same reason, the heavy materials like iron sank into the core, and the lighter ones like continents and air floated up to the top. Actually, Round World isn't exactly a sphere because it rotates, so centrifugal forces cause it to bulge at the equator. But the amount of bulge is only 1/3 of 1%, and that bulging shape is the minimum energy configuration for a mass of liquid spinning at the same speed as the Earth's rotation when it was just starting to solidify. The physics here isn't important for the message of this book. What is important is the worlds of if point of view involved in the application of phase spaces. When we discuss the shape of water in a pond, we pretty much ignored the flat surface, the thing we were trying to explain. The entire argument hinged upon non-flat surfaces, humps and dips, and hypothetical transfers of water from one to the other. Almost all of the explanation involved thinking about things that don't actually happen. Only at the end, having ruled out all non-flat surfaces, did we observe that the only possibility left was therefore what the water would actually do. The same goes for the bubble. At first sight, this might seem to be a very oblique way of doing physics. It takes the stance that the way to understand the real world is to ignore it and focus instead on all possible alternative unreal worlds. Then we find some principle, in this case minimum energy, to rule out nearly all of the unreal worlds and see what's left. Wouldn't it be easier to start with the real world and focus solely on that? No, it wouldn't. As we've just seen, the real world alone is too limited to offer a convincing explanation. What you get from the real world alone is, the world is like it is, and there's nothing more to be said. However, if you take the imaginative leap of considering unreal worlds too, you can compare the real world with all of those unreal worlds and maybe find a principle that picks out the real one from all the others. Then you have answered the question, why is the world the way it is, rather than something else? An excellent way to approach why questions is to consider alternatives and rule them out. Why did you park the car around the corner down a side street? Because if I'd parked outside the front door on the double yellow lines, a traffic warden would have given me a parking ticket. This particular why question is a story, a piece of fiction, a hypothetical discussion of the likely consequences of an action that never occurred. Humans invented their own brand of narrativium as an aid to the exploration of I space, the space of insteads. Narrative provides I space with a geography. If I did this instead of that, then what would happen would be... On Discworld, phase spaces are real. The fictitious alternatives to one actual state exist too, and you can get inside the phase space and roam over its landscape, provided you know the right spells, secret entrances, and other magical paraphernalia. L-space is a case in point. On Roundworld, we can pretend that phase space exists, and we can imagine exploring its geography. This pretense has turned out to be extraordinarily insightful. Associated with any physical system, then, is a phase space, a space of the possible. If you're studying the solar system, then the phase space comprises all possible ways to arrange one star, nine planets, a considerable number of moons, and a gigantic number of asteroids in space. If you're studying a sand pile, then the phase space comprises the number of possible ways to arrange several million grains of sand. If you're studying thermodynamics, then the phase space comprises all possible positions and velocities for a large number of gas molecules. Indeed, for each molecule, there are three position coordinates and three velocity coordinates, because the molecule lives in three-dimensional space. So with n molecules, there are 6n coordinates altogether. If you're looking at games of chess, then the phase space consists of all possible positions of the pieces on the board. If you're thinking about all possible books, then the phase space is L space. And if you're thinking about all possible universes, you're contemplating U space. Each point of U space is an entire universe, and you have to invent the multiverse to hold them all. When cosmologists think about varying the natural constants, as we described in Chapter 2 in connection with the carbon resonance in stars, they are thinking about one tiny and rather obvious piece of U-space, the part that can be derived from our universe by changing the fundamental constants, but otherwise keeping the laws the same. There are infinitely many other ways to set up an alternative universe. They range from having 101 dimensions and totally different laws to being identical with our universe except for 6 atoms of dysprosium in the core of the star Procyon that changed into iodine on Thursdays. As this example suggests, the first thing to appreciate about phase spaces is that they are generally rather big. What the universe actually does is a tiny proportion of all the things it could have done instead. For instance, suppose that a car park has 100 parking slots, and that the cars are either red, blue, green, white, or black. When the car park is full, how many different patterns of color are there? Ignore the make of car, ignore how well or badly it is parked, focus solely on the pattern of colors. Mathematicians call this kind of question combinatorics, and they have devised all sorts of clever ways to find answers. Roughly speaking, combinatorics is the art of counting things without actually counting them. Many years ago, a mathematical acquaintance of ours came across a university administrator counting light bulbs in the roof of a lecture hall, The lights were arranged in a perfect rectangular grid, 10 by 20. The administrator was staring at the ceiling, going, 49, 50, 51, 200, said the mathematician. How do you know that? Well, it's a 10 by 20 grid, and 10 times 20 is 200. No, no, replied the administrator. I want the exact number. The bean counters don't even know how to count beans sensibly. I'll be surprised. Back to those cars. There are five colours, and each slot can be filled by just one of them. So there are five ways to fill the first slot, five ways to fill the second, and so on. Any way to fill the first slot can be combined with any way to fill the second. So these two slots can be filled in 5 times 5 equals 25 ways. Each of those can be combined with any of the five ways to fill the third slot. So now we have 25 times 5, 125 possibilities. By the same reasoning, the total number of ways to fill the whole car park is 5 times 5 times 5 times 5 with 100 fives. This is 5 to the power of 100, which is rather big. To be precise, it is 7 8 8 8 6 0 9 0 5 2 2 1 0 1 1 8 0 5 4 1 1 7 2 8 5 6 5 2 8 2 7 8 6 2 2 9 6 7 3 2 0 6 4 3 5 1 0 9 0 2 3 0 0 4 7 7 0 2 7 8 9 3 0 6 6 4 0 6 2 5. Which has 70 digits. It took a computer algebra system about 5 seconds to work that out, by the way, and about 4.999 of those seconds were taken up with giving it the instructions, and most of the rest was used up printing the result to the screen. Anyway, you now see why combinatorics is the art of counting without actually counting. If you listed all the possibilities and counted them, 1, 2, 3, 4, you'd never finish. So it's a good job that the university administrator wasn't in charge of car parking. How big is L space? The librarian said it is infinite, which is true if you used infinity to mean a much larger number than I can envisage, or if you don't place an upper limit on how big a book can be. A tour of any airport bookshop will show you that this is reasonable. Or if you allow all possible alphabets, syllabaries, and pictograms. If we stick to ordinary-sized English books, we can reduce the estimate. A typical book is 100,000 words long, or about 600,000 characters, letters and spaces, we'll ignore punctuation marks. There are 26 letters in the English alphabet, plus a space, making 27 characters that can go into each of the 600,000 possible positions. The counting principle that we used to solve the car parking problem now implies that the maximum number of books of this length is 27 to the power of 600,000, which is roughly 10 to the power of 860,000. That is an 860,000-digit number. Of course, most of those books make very little sense, because we've not yet insisted that the letters make sensible words. If we assume that the words are drawn from a list of 10,000 standard ones and calculate the number of ways to arrange 100,000 words in order, then the figure changes to 10,000 to the power of 100,000, equal to 10 to the power of 400,000. And this is quite a bit smaller, but still enormous. Mind you, most of those books wouldn't make much sense either. They'd read something like cabbage, patronymic, forgotten, prohibit, hostile, quintessence, continuing at book length. But Joycean scholars would be furious if we excluded Finnegan's Wake, which reads exactly like that. So maybe we ought to work with sentences. At any rate, even if we cut the numbers down in that manner, it turns out that the universe is not big enough to contain that many physical books. So it's a good idea that L space is available. And now we know why there's never enough shelf space. We like to think that our major libraries, such as the British Library or the Library of Congress, are pretty big. But in fact, the space of those books that actually exist is a tiny, tiny fraction of L space, of all the books that could have existed. In particular, we're never going to run out of new books to write. Poincaré's phase space viewpoint has proved to be so useful that nowadays you'll find it in every area of science, and in areas that aren't science at all. A major consumer of phase spaces is economics. Suppose that a national economy involves a million different goods, cheese, bicycles, rats on a stick, and so on. Associated with each good is a price, say £2.35 for a lump of cheese, £449.99 for a bicycle, £15 for a rat on a stick. So the state of the economy is a list of 1 million numbers. The phase space consists of all possible lists of a million numbers, including many lists that make no economic sense at all, such as lists that include a 2 pence bicycle, or the £999,999,999.95 rat. The economist's job is to discover the principles that select from the space of all possible lists of numbers the actual list that is observed. The classic principle of this kind is the law of supply and demand, which says that if goods are in short supply and you really, really want them, then the price goes up. It sometimes works, but it often doesn't. Finding such laws is something of a black art, and the results are not totally convincing, but that just tells us that economics is hard. Poor results notwithstanding, the economist's way of thinking is a phase-space point of view. Here's a little tale that shows just how far removed economic theory is from reality. The basis of conventional economics is the idea of a rational agent with perfect information who maximizes utility. According to these assumptions, a taxi driver, for example, will arrange his activities to generate the most money for the least effort. Now, the income of a taxi driver depends on circumstances. On good days, with lots of passengers around, he will do well. On bad days, he won't. A rational taxi driver will therefore work longer on good days and give up early on bad ones. However, a study of taxi drivers in New York carried out by Colin Camara and others shows the exact opposite. The taxi drivers seem to set themselves a daily target and stop working once they reach it. So they work shorter hours on good days and longer hours on bad ones. They could increase their earnings by 8% just by working the same number of hours every day for the same total working time. If they worked longer on good days and shorter on bad ones, they could increase their earnings by 15%. But they don't have a good enough intuition for economic phase space to appreciate this. They are adopting a common human trait of placing too much value on what they have today and too little on what they may gain tomorrow. Biology, too, has been invaded by phase spaces. The first of these to gain widespread currency was DNA space. Associated with every living organism is its genome, a string of chemical molecules called DNA. The DNA molecule is a double helix. Two spirals wrap round a common core. Each spiral is made up of a string of bases, or nucleotides, which come in four varieties: cytosine, guanine, adenine, thymine, normally abbreviated to their initials, CGAT. The sequences on the two strings are complementary. Wherever C appears on one string, you get G on the other, and similarly for A and T. So the DNA contains two copies of the sequence, one positive and one negative, so to speak. In the abstract, then, the genome can be thought of as a single sequence of these four letters, something like AA, TGG, CC, TCAG, going on for rather a long time. The human genome, for example, goes on for about 3 billion letters. The phase space for genomes, DNA space, consists of all possible sequences of a given length. If we're thinking about human beings, the relevant DNA space comprises all possible sequences of 3 billion code letters CGAT. How big is that space? It's the same problem as the cars in the car park, mathematically speaking, so the answer is 4 × 4 × 4 × 4 × 4, with 3 billion 4s. That is, 4 to the power of 3 billion. This number is a lot bigger than the 70-digit number we got for the car parking problem. It's a lot bigger than L space for normal-sized books, too. In fact, it has about 1,800 million digits. If you wrote it out with 3,000 digits per page, you'd need a 600,000-page book to hold it. The image of DNA space is very useful for geneticists who are considering possible changes to DNA sequences, such as point mutations where one code letter is changed, say as the result of a copying error, or an incoming high-energy cosmic ray. Viruses in particular mutate so rapidly that it makes little sense to talk of a viral species as a fixed thing. Instead, biologists talk of quasi-species and visualize these as clusters of related sequences in DNA space. The clusters slosh around as time passes, but they stay together as one cluster, which allows the virus to retain its identity. In the whole of human history, the total number of people has been no more than 10 billion, a mere 11-digit number. This is an incredibly tiny fraction of all those possibilities. So actual human beings have explored the tiniest portion of DNA space, just as actual books have explored the tiniest portion of L space. Of course, the interesting questions are not as straightforward as that. Most sequences of letters do not make up a sensible book. Most DNA sequences do not correspond to a viable organism, let alone a human being. And now we come to the crunch for phase spaces. In physics, it is reasonable to assume that the sensible phase space can be pre-stated before tackling questions about the corresponding system. We can imagine rearranging the bodies of the solar system into any configuration in that imaginary phase space. We lack the engineering capacity to do that, but we have no difficulty imagining it done. And we see no physical reason to remove any particular configuration from consideration. When it comes to DNA space, however, the important questions are not about the whole of that vast space of all possible sequences. Nearly all of those sequences correspond to no organism whatsoever, not even a dead one. What we really need to consider is viable DNA space, the space of all DNA sequences that could be realized within some viable organism. This is some immensely complicated but very thin part of DNA space, and we don't know what it is. We have no idea how to look at a hypothetical DNA sequence and decide whether it can occur in a viable organism. The same problem arises in connection with L space, but there's a twist. A literate human can look at a sequence of letters and spaces and decide whether it constitutes a story. They know how to read the code and work out its meaning, if it's in a language they understand. They can even make a stab at deciding whether it's a good story or a bad one. However, we do not know how to transfer this ability to a computer. The rules that our minds use to decide whether what we're reading is a story are implicit in the networks of nerve cells in our brains. Nobody has yet been able to make those rules explicit. We don't know how to characterize the readable books subset of L space. For DNA, the problem is compounded, because there isn't some kind of fixed rule that translates a DNA code into an organism. Biologists used to think there would be, and had high hopes of learning the language involved. Then the DNA for a genuine, potential organism would be a code sequence that told a coherent story of biological development, and all other DNA sequences would be gibberish. In effect, the biologists expected to be able to look at the DNA sequence of a tiger and see the bit that specified the stripes, the bit that specified the claws, and so on. This was a bit optimistic. The current state of the art is that we can see the bit of DNA that specifies the protein from which claws are made, or the bits that make the orange, black, and white pigments of the fur that show up as stripes, but that's about as far as our understanding of DNA narrative goes. It is now becoming clear that many non-genetic factors go into the growth of an organism too, so even in principle, there may not be a language that translates DNA into living creatures. For example, tiger DNA turns into a baby tiger only in the presence of an egg supplied by a mother tiger. The same DNA in the presence of a mongoose egg would not make a tiger at all. Now, it could be that this is just a technical problem, that for each DNA code there is a unique kind of mother organism that turns it into a living creature, so that the form of that creature is still implicit in the code. But theoretically, at least, the same DNA code could make two totally different organisms. We give an example in the chapter The Collapse of Chaos, where the developing organism first looks to see what kind of mother it is in, and then develops in different ways, depending on what it sees. Complexity guru Stuart Kaufman has taken this difficulty a stage further. He points out that while in physics we can expect to pre-state the phase space of a system, the same is never true in biology. Biological systems are more creative than physical ones. The organization of matter within living creatures is of a different qualitative nature from the organization we find in inorganic matter. In particular, organisms can evolve, and when they do that, they often become more complicated. The fish-like ancestor of humans was less complicated than we are today, for example. We've not specified a measure of complexity here, but that statement will be reasonable for most sensible measures of complexity, so let's not worry about definitions. Evolution does not necessarily increase complexity, but it's at its most puzzling when it does. Kaufman contrasts two systems. One is the traditional thermodynamic model in physics, of N-gas molecules, modelled as hard spheres, bouncing around inside their 6N-dimensional phase space. Here we know the phase space in advance. We can specify the dynamic precisely, and we can deduce general laws. Among them is the second law of thermodynamics, which states that, with overwhelming probability, the system will become more disordered as time passes, and the molecules will distribute themselves uniformly throughout their container. The second system is the biosphere, an evolving ecology. Here, it is not at all clear which phase space to use. Potential choices are either much too big or much too limited. Suppose for a moment that the old biologist's dream of a DNA language for organisms was true. Then we might hope to employ DNA space as our phase space. However, as we've just seen, only a tiny, intricate subset of that space would really be of interest, but we can't work out which subset. When you add to that the probable non-existence of any such language, the whole approach falls apart. On the other hand, if the phase space is too small, entirely reasonable changes might take the organisms outside it altogether. For example, tiger space might be defined in terms of the number of stripes on the big cat's body. But if one day a big cat evolves that has spots instead of stripes, there's no place for it in the tiger phase space. Sure, it's not a tiger, but its mother was. We can't sensibly exclude this kind of innovation if we want to understand real biology. As organisms evolve, they change. Sometimes evolution can be seen as the opening up of a region of phase space that was sitting there waiting, but was not occupied by organisms. If the colours and patterns on an insect change a bit, all that we're seeing is the exploration of new regions of a fairly well-defined insect space. But when an entirely new trick, wings, appears, even the phase space seems to have changed. It is very difficult to capture the phenomenon of innovation in a mathematical model. Mathematicians like to pre-state the space of possibilities, but the whole point about innovation is that it opens up new possibilities that were previously not envisaged. So Kaufman suggests that a key feature of the biosphere is the inability to pre-state a phase space for it. At risk of muddying the waters, it is worth observing that even in physics, pre-stating the phase space is not as straightforward as it might appear. What happens to the phase space of the solar system if we allow bodies to break up or merge? Supposedly, see The Science of Discworld, A Giant Leap for Moonkind, the moon was splashed off the Earth when it collided with a body about the size of Mars. Before that event, there was no moon coordinate in the phase space of the solar system. Afterwards, there was. So the phase space expanded when the moon came into being. The phase spaces of physics always assume a fixed context. In physics, you can usually get away with that assumption. In biology, you can't. There's a second problem in physics too. That 6n dimensional phase space of thermodynamics, for example, is too big. It includes non-physical states. By a quirk of mathematics, the laws of motion for elastic spheres do not prescribe what happens when three or more collide simultaneously. So we must excise from that nice, simple 6n dimensional space all configurations that experience a triple collision somewhere in their past or future. We know four things about these configurations. They are very rare, they can occur, they form an extremely complicated cloud of points in phase space, and it is impossible in any practical sense to determine whether a given configuration should or should not be excised. If these unphysical states were a bit more common, then the thermodynamic phase space would be just as hard to pre-state as that for the biosphere. However, they are a vanishingly small proportion of the whole, so we can just about get away with ignoring them. Nonetheless, it is possible to go some way towards pre-stating a phase space for the biosphere. While we cannot pre-state a space of all possible organisms, we can look at any given organism and at least in principle say what the potential immediate changes are. That is, we can describe the space of the adjacent possible, the local phase space. Innovation then becomes the process of expanding into the adjacent possible. This is a reasonable and fairly conventional idea. But more controversially, Kaufman suggests the exciting possibility that there may be general laws that govern this kind of expansion, laws that have exactly the opposite effect to the famous second law of thermodynamics. The second law, in effect, states that thermodynamic systems become simpler as time passes. All of the interesting structure gets smeared out and disappears. In contrast, Kaufman's suggestion is that the biosphere expands into the space of the adjacent possible at the maximum rate that it can, subject to hanging together as a biological system. Innovation in biology happens as rapidly as possible. More generally, Kaufman extends this idea to any system composed of autonomous agents. An autonomous agent is a generalized life form defined by two properties. It can reproduce, and it can carry out at least one thermodynamic work cycle. A work cycle occurs when a system does work and returns to its original state, ready to do the same again. That is, the system takes energy from its environment and transforms it into work, and does so in such a manner that at the end of the cycle, it returns to its initial state. A human being is an autonomous agent, and so is a tiger. A flame is not. Flames reproduce by spreading to inflammable material nearby, but they do not carry out a work cycle. They turn chemical energy into fire, but once something has been burnt, it can't be burnt a second time. This theory of autonomous agents is explicitly set in the context of phase spaces. Without such a concept, it cannot even be described. And in this theory, we see the first possibility of obtaining a general understanding of the principles whereby and wherefore organisms complicate themselves. We are starting to pin down just what it is about life forms that makes them behave so differently from the boring prescription of the second law of thermodynamics. We paint a picture of the universe as a source of ever-increasing complexity and organization, instead of the exact opposite. We find out why we live in an interesting universe instead of a dull one.